supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's a question on many minds as the snow finally melts away. How much should we feed our lawn to make it look nice and not glow in the dark? And how much does it really need? We'll tell you in the question of the week. We'll also reveal that it's the law of the land in several states now, not to overfeed your lawn. That's very interesting, but first, it's lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dennis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Dennis. How are you?
Good.
And where is Dennis Good?
In Buckingham, Pennsylvania.
What can we do for Dennis in Buckingham?
Well, I have a problem with a fig. Actually, I have several figs in barrels. They're not a problem because they produced 100 figs last year, and they're hibernating in my garage currently.
Okay.
But my son, who is a great container gardener and has 60 barrels up on his roof in Washington, D.C., a couple of years ago gave me a Chicago fig, which is supposed to be able to last outside over winters here. So I planted it a couple of years ago, and it was doing fine. It was doing great last year, had leaves on it. I covered it with a cage and some netting so that no animals would get to it. And at the end of the summer, around September, my wife said, well, take the cage off, take the cover off. We don't need it anymore. The leaves are going to die soon. So I did. And lo and behold, within a day or two, some animal must have come along with a pruning shears and cut off two of the stalks right at like 1 foot up off the ground. So I covered it over to protect it, but I took these two stalks and I cut off the ends about 3 or 4 inches each off the tops because they had nice little buds on them, and I stuck them in a glass of water.
Okay.
This is like October 1st.
Okay.
And so they have started making little leaves, and they're alive.
Yes.
And by Christmas time, they would look like they were sprouting, but they don't seem to have any roots.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I would like to be able to root them somehow and then stick them back in the ground at some point.
All they're waiting for is dirt, honey. Let's back up a little bit.
Yeah.
All figs are hardy enough to last throughout a winter in your suburb of Philadelphia if you protect them over winter. Here's the deal with figs.
Okay.
Figs are Mediterranean plants.
Right.
So the top parts of the fig, the most exposed area of the fig, they want a Mediterranean climate. But there is something about the root system of a fig that comes from the planet Krypton. Even in the coldest winters, even an exposed fig plant in your area, even a plant that loses all of its above ground growth to the horrors of winter, will still send up new shoots from the root system in the spring. The problem becomes if you don't protect it in one way or another, because all the top growth is dead, it doesn't have enough time to grow the biomass to produce a good crop of figs.
Right.
So what most people do is at the end of the growing season, they will build a little house, you know, drive some stakes into the ground around the tree, and then wrap burlap around the stakes simply to limit the winter damage. And then in the spring, they'll remove that burlap, and then they'll prune off any damaged areas. But obviously, they have a very large plant that will begin growing from that point, so there's plenty of time for it to put on fruit. You appear to be taking your trees into a presumably unheated garage so they go dormant.
Right.
And suffer little to no winter injury, and then you drag them back out in the spring, and they start growing again. Even if there is no winter damage, I would recommend you give all of them a gentle pruning when you bring them out in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Figs love to be pruned in the spring, and that'll encourage good fast growth, which will make sure you get a nice crop of figs.
But I'm more concerned about the ones that
are going
in the ground, and I want to get those little shoots to root.
If we could go back in time, what I would have told you to do is wrap all those shoots together, tie them up with some ribbon, and bury them in the ground about 6 inches below ground.
Okay.
and mark that spot well, dig them up in the spring. That's one of the classic methods of plant propagation. That's a hardwood cutting. That's a cutting you take at the end of the year. You take the cuttings, you bury them below the frost line, you dig them up, and then you properly propagate them in the spring. With most plants, with your cuttings, what I would advise is you would fill a pot that has good drainage holes with a good loose seed starting mix and grow them in that until they had a good root system, and then transplant them into some place they can stay outside in a protected area. Because figs wish to root so much, the truth is, as soon as the soil is workable and warm and dry, and you take them outside, find a nice protected spot for them, put the cuttings gently in the ground, dig a hole and drop them in. Don't shove the cuttings in. You don't want to break up all that gentle material at the edge of the plant. And then just keep them watered, and they're going to develop their own roots without having a go-between in between.
That sounds great.
All right. Good luck, Dennis.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Gary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
I live in a place called Cherokee Lake, East Tennessee, about 50 minutes southeast of Knoxville.
Okay, Cherokee Lake. It sounds scenic. Do you actually have a lake?
Cherokee Lake is a really large flood control lake. It's about 55 miles long. It's a beautiful, beautiful, spectacular place to live.
So was it a natural one, or is it one of these lakes that was created, like Lake Nockamixon near me?
No, it was created. TVA had created those lakes for flood control and hydroelectric power. It is one of many lakes in East Tennessee.
Right now, all around the country, they're deciding whether to open these things up and undam them and what to do with them and everything.
Yes, sir, you're correct.
All right. Well, is that what you want to talk about, or you got a more personal question?
No, sir. I have a personal question. I have a 3-acre property, and I live 600 feet off the road in the center of the property.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a neighbor whom I love dearly, but he got himself a chainsaw and a small tractor, and he has decimated the woodlot next to my property. At nighttime, I like to sit on the front porch and listen to the crickets and watch the fireflies, and now I see his porch light. I am prepared to put an 8-foot-high chicken wire fence clear along that 200-foot edge of property there. I need something that will climb that thing. I want to build a green wall around that property.
Okay, well,
I don't care what it is, just so it's fast, thick, and green.
You know, I'll remind you, that also spells out invasive. You realize that, don't you?
I know about wisteria. I know about pompous grass.
Gary's growing kudzu. Gary's growing kudzu.
I'm not going to plant kudzu. No, sir.
Now,
well, I'm a practical person. I'm 68 years old.
Okay.
So I want to enjoy this stuff. So what, over the next 10 years?
Yeah, you're not planting for the next generation.
I'm just planning to enjoy life for what I have left.
Well, first, chicken wire won't work. Chicken wire is just not strong enough. So you're talking a chain link fence if you want to pursue this. You're talking a cyclone fence. Or else the thing's just going to sag and fall apart and go down in the first storm. What I suggest for people in your situation, plants that are highly ornamental, that grow fast, that are relatively problem-free, and that I think might be able to work in your situation, is staggered ornamental grasses.
Okay.
Tall ornamental grasses. Make sure you avoid the one or two that are invasive. That leaves you about 50 different varieties. You know they grow a ton of biomass in their first year, and then you leave it alone. You don't trim it before the winter or even after the winter, and then you allow it to just keep getting bigger across the sides, and it will continue to get taller. And if you get the ones with the plumes, then you've got 10 or 12 feet of height, no problem. But within a year or two, you've got your, quote, living fence, But it doesn't have brittle branches hanging down. It isn't dropping leaves. It has four-color interest. And it's amazing to look at. I think ornamental grasses are the most underutilized plants in our landscape. And they're ideal when people want to cover up a view like this. If you go to youbetyourgarden.org, go to Garden Answers A to Z, and look under P for privacy and or S for screening. We probably have a couple of articles under O for ornamental grasses. The most important thing, and this is under the screening and privacy, is to stagger them. Plant them in triangles, not in a straight line. And that way you get much more effective screening and a cleaner look.
Wow, this is great. And this sounds like a lot less work. Boy, this is the best phone call I've ever made. It saved me a lot of trouble. I would have taken a totally incorrect route with this.
That's why
I appreciate it.
That's why we're here, man.
Super. Thank you so much.
All right. You take care, Gary.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the famed Philadelphia Flower Show opens Saturday, March 1st and runs through March 9th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philadelphia. And that I will be there to answer your garden questions live and in person at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 5th in the Gardener's Studio, which is on the show floor. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and the timing for two simple feedings that will give you the nicest looking lawn in the neighborhood. I'm nice looking Mike McGrath. And this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 70 new varieties for the 2014 growing season, including Steakhouse, a 3-pound-plus beefsteak tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, American lawns get a bad rap. People think they're ecologically unsound because they're overfed and over-chemicalized, especially over-fertilized. Well, that's true, and it's all unnecessary. You don't have to rip up your lawn. Just follow the two simple feeding schedule that we'll tell you when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marnie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Marnie. How are you?
I'm good.
And where is Marnie good?
I'm in Germantown in northwest Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. The Germantown section of Philadelphia, one of our oldest neighborhoods.
That's right.
What can we do for Marnie in Germantown?
Last fall, I was busy landscaping and planting lots of new plants. And I had ordered hundreds of new flowering bulbs. But lo and behold, the fall got away from me before the cold weather hit, and I never got them in the ground. What do I do with these suckers? They were starting. I had them sitting in my living room waiting for the next warm day,
right
through November. And then, of course, we had this terrible cold winter. And I never got them in the ground. So I have all these bulbs that are dying to start blooming. And is it still possible to get them in the ground early spring and have
no
bloom?
See, what they need is they need that period of chilling.
Yeah.
And root development. My friend Art Walk, who wrote a great book on forcing your own flower bulbs, explained that it's an easy relationship if you've got the bulbs in the ground. But when you're trying to do it like him, to have super specimens ready for the flower show a month before they would normally emerge, you need a certain number of hours of chilling during which they'll grow like little roots and they'll get their chilling requirement in. And then they need to be brought into the right conditions so that the flower is comfortable coming up the center of that stalk and actually blooming. So the smart money would have said, even if you had to shovel snow during a warm day, to try to have gotten them in the ground still in November, that probably would have worked well for you. Now, here's a real weird question for you. Do you have an extra fridge? Do you have a beer fridge in the basement?
I don't, but I can ask around. But my basement is so chilly, it might as well be outdoors.
And so you did take them down to a chilly basement,
yep.
But you left them down there naked.
Yep. Mm.
You probably would have been better if we had talked in December or something like that.
Yeah.
They pretty much have one shot. They've got to be carried through to at least, if not flowering, leafing out at the right time every year. Now, what you could do is go out and get a whole bunch or, you know, you might even have them already, normal planting pots.
Yeah, I got lots of those.
Yeah, exactly. Pots that hold a quart, 2 quarts of soil. And what I want you to do is fill the pots about halfway up with a good, loose, light, professional mix, soil-free mix, seed-starting mix, with a little bit of compost mixed in. Mostly light and loose, but a little bit of compost in there. And then in each pot, I want you to really jam the bulbs in. Right side to side, neck to neck. Just as many bulbs as you can fit in each pot. And then cover them with more of that seed starting mix and compost mixture. And then take each pot to a sink and let it sit there for 2 hours until the medium is totally saturated. And do that until you got all your bulbs planted. And then you want to keep those in a place that's going to be around 45 degrees, no warmer than that. Between 40 and 45 degrees for 16 to 18 weeks. And you need to mark the dates. It doesn't matter kind of what you have. If you can get them in that soil and get them planted, they need to be in the soil because first they have to develop roots or it's not going to work. You will not feed them other than that compost. You won't water them again. And you will keep them in the dark, in the cold. This can be in a refrigerator. It can be in, you know, some cold, dark area of a basement. You can take them out to Crystal Cave, you know, where it's always 50 degrees. But ideally, you want to keep them right around 45 degrees. And I'm not kidding. You want to do it for 16 to 18 weeks. And then at the end of that time, I would bring them up one by one, and I would not put them outside because at that point it's probably going to be too hot outside. I would bring them inside, keep them in like a cool spot of the house, water them once, and with any luck, they will come up and sprout indoors for you as forced plants like at the flower show.
Okay.
And then after the flowers fade, then you take the pots outside, you give everything a gentle feeding, and you leave the green leaves absorb solar energy until the end of the season, and then you give them at least a month or two of rest, and then you plant them in the ground somewhere between Halloween and Thanksgiving. But the most important thing now is they have to be encased in dirt. The dirt has to be saturated to begin with, and then they got to be at around 40 to 45 degrees for 16 to 18 weeks.
All right. So they're still salvageable.
Right.
Once I get them in the ground next fall, then they should get back to the normal cycle.
Yeah, they may go a little blahooey the first year, but after that they should get settled in.
Okay. So there's no reason to just pitch them, because I was afraid they'd be ruined because they haven't been in the ground.
If you don't want to participate in this great adventure, you can compost them, but those are the two options.
Oh, no.
And this
no.
is not a felony. This is a misdemeanor. This is the most common crime in gardening, unplanted spring bulbs.
Great.
Good luck, Marnie.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Love your show. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Reed, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Reed. How are you, sir?
I'm thawing out up here in St. Paul, Minnesota. We're in the 40s today.
Oh, in the 40s. Well, don't get used to it, baby. It's going to go back down again. You know that.
Oh, for sure.
Up in Minnesota. Well, we know how you feel this year. We got hammered.
Right.
Well, what can we do for you, Reed?
I'm wondering if I buy seeds in a climate that's more similar to mine, will the plants do better? Or is it okay to buy, say, from Florida and grow up in Minnesota?
Well, that's an excellent question. With plants, for instance, buying live plants and things like garlic, I think it's crucial to buy from a local supplier or to at least buy it from someone who's in the same climate as you are. You certainly don't want to buy garlic or onions that were raised in Texas, for instance, and then
right.
try to plant those cloves or sets in Minnesota. You want something that's already been through a couple of life cycles in a freezing cold environment. Same thing with trees and shrubs. Even if they're the same basic species, you know, you're going to buy something that's preferably 2 or 3 years old, and you would prefer it to be from somewhere in the north, not necessarily Minnesota, but Wisconsin or you know, someplace with a similar climate.
Yep.
Now, with gardening seeds, it doesn't make all that much difference, but how long have you lived in Minnesota?
For 33 years.
Okay. So you know that you're looking for mostly short season varieties, unless you're going to be doing a lot of building projects. And that's
correct.
The difference you're going to find among different seed suppliers. There are specialty suppliers who, for instance, only sell theoretically, tomato seeds, although these days they sell pepper seeds and cucumber seeds too. And there's general seed companies, there's local seed companies, there's companies that specialize in high altitude plants. And for instance, with them, it's crucially important that you at least look at their advice and seek out their wisdom. And if you're going to do that, you better buy their seeds too, because their stuff will be adapted to grow in that very different environment of growing at altitude. With you, the advantage of buying from a supplier who would be local or who specializes in cold climate gardening is you wouldn't be lured down the garden path by any 180-day watermelons or 110-day tomatoes or something like that. I also think that if you could get plants from a local supplier who saves seed and they've been growing their tomatoes out for, say, 10 years up there in the frozen north, that their early girl might be a little earlier than an early girl that was bred and developed in Chicago or Los Angeles or Pennsylvania. But in general, with seeds, the plants are going to follow the days to maturity. Although you've also learned the trick that the days to maturity kind of have to be adjusted for people in your climate.
Correct.
Sometimes the opposite way, though, because your summer days are longer than mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you very much. I got to run.
Okay. Well, you have a great season. With plants, it's really important. With seeds, just remember, make sure you have enough days to grow it out when you're up that far north.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mike.
All right. Take care, Reed.
Yeah, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim. How are you, sir?
I'm well.
And where is Jim well?
In Lansdale, PA.
Just outside of Philadelphia. All right. What can we do for Jim in Lansdale?
Well, I've had a problem with these tiny ground hiving bees that never bother you. But a year ago this summer, they gathered near the front door and near a boxwood bush. And by the end of the year, the boxwood bush turned yellow and brown. And I went digging and found that there was an entire cavity that the bees had made surrounding the root system. So obviously the bush was not getting very much of any water. So I replaced that bush, and then this immediate past summer, I have a boxwood hedge in the back of the house, far away from the other one. And the same thing happened at the fall. One of the boxwood bushes turned yellow, then brown. And when I went searching, I found all the soil around the roots gone and some honeycomb and other things from these little bees. I don't want to hurt the bees because we need them. And secondly, I want to know what I can do to prevent them. And thirdly, I want to know what is this affinity to boxwood roots.
What leads you to believe that these are bees and not yellow jackets?
Well, they're not yellow jackets. I know a yellow jacket. They're much smaller.
You're saying these appear late in the season, in the summertime?
No, I don't know when they actually appear. Never paid much attention to them. But when this bush started getting brown, I started getting interesting as to what was causing it. And as soon as I hit down in the area, they came out in large numbers. Didn't bother me. But so then I went probing, as I did on the bush the prior year, and the same thing. They had created this cavity.
So you started to dig the nest out at the end of the season and didn't get stung?
Yep.
This is highly unusual. Typically, when you have a large underground nest, that's yellow jackets. I don't know of any native bees that nest in the ground in large numbers. Now, very soon in the springtime, we're going to see all sorts of native bees making individual nests or very small colonies in lawns and bare patches of grass. And these are the really important bees. These are the different bumblebees. These are the squash bees, the sweat bees. These are the native bees that do 3/4 of the pollination of all the garden crops. When you talk about a large colony underground, you're typically talking about yellow jackets, which almost always make their nests in the ground, and they make the kind of nest that you're describing, but, you know, they're fiercely aggressive.
These are very docile, except when I probed.
They didn't sting you, but they acted threatening.
They acted threatening, and I took their hint, and I departed.
But they didn't sting you once?
No, never.
Okay, all right, so they're not yellow jackets. Okay, so you're growing boxwoods. Number one, do you make sure your boxwoods have alkaline soil?
No, I had them put in 3 years ago, and I just give them the regular green bush fertilizer each year, the spikes.
I'd rather you not feed them anything than to feed them chemical spikes. Boxwoods are unlike other evergreens. If you feed a boxwood plant fertilizer labeled for all evergreens, the boxwoods will slowly die.
Okay.
Because they require alkaline soil and they require very different treatment from a true evergreen. So it's quite possible that even though there was a little nest down there, that the boxwoods are dying off because you're poisoning them with chemical fertilizer spikes and their soil is not acidic enough. So okay. I'd like you to investigate what boxwoods really need. Are they mulched with anything?
Yeah, root mulch, a couple inches.
Okay, well, that's bad for them as well. If you go to our website, go to the show's website, youbetyourgarden.org, and go under B for boxwood, you will see that these are backwards plants. Everything that people think they need to do actually injures boxwoods. So I think your boxwoods may be dying because of this nasty mulch and the chemical fertilizer and the pH of their soil. What boxwoods mostly want is to have bare soil underneath them. Test the soil. It's probably become very acidic. And what you want to do is dust some wood ash or lime around the plants.
Okay.
And then other than that, I can assure you, no matter what these little creatures are, they will not reuse old nests, as you've seen. I think it's just a bizarre coincidence that they're attacking your boxwoods, although I think they may be going in there because they sense that the plants are weakened and stressed, and those roots were already dying. So even though it seems counterintuitive, I think you need to learn how to take care of boxwood differently. And once you do that, I predict these nests will stop appearing underneath.
Very good. I will go to your website.
Give it a shot. Get rid of the mulch. Give them some wood ash. No more plant spikes. And I predict good times ahead.
Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Jim.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be one of the special guests at the 10th annual edition of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a fundraiser for the Philadelphia area community of Mount Airy. It'll be at the historic Sedgwick Theater on Saturday evening, March 14th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and the secret behind the two simple feedings that are all your lawn needs to be happy and healthy. I'm happy and healthy Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Verbee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 70 new varieties for the 2014 growing season, including Steakhouse, a 3-pound plus beefsteak tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch right now, cats and kittens. Did you know that Maryland and Virginia now have new laws in place that restrict the times you can feed your lawn and the amounts of nitrogen that you can feed them? Well, these laws actually mirror the good organic advice for having a safe and sane, yet green and beautiful lawn. We'll tell you all about them and reveal the two feedings that are all your lawn needs after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Peter, welcome to You About Your Garden.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you, yep, and I'm really glad to be on your show.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. Where are you?
Center City, Philadelphia.
Really? Whereabouts?
The place I'm asking about is on the other side of Rittenhouse Square, sort of 22nd and Delancey.
What can we do for Peter just off of Delancey?
Well, I was lucky enough to recently take a trip to Paris, and I ate wonderfully. What I kept getting were these great salads. And it was this lettuce that wasn't just filler. It was just delicious. It had flavor. It was crunchy, but it was moist. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them what it was. They said it was Batavia lettuce.
Right, right. Well-known gourmet variety, I should say.
And I came back, and I've been looking for it, and I can't find it in any of the produce places. I go online, and I find seeds, but I can't find where anybody sells it, which made me want to grow it myself, but as I live in a brownstone with no yard, my question is it possible for me to raise something like that indoors, either hydroponically or with lights and soil, so that I could enjoy this wonderful lettuce all year round?
Yes, it is. Now, I'm going to outline your other options. Is there a community garden near you?
There is actually one over by the Schuylkill River.
I know that. That's why I asked. So my first suggestion is, have you seen if you could get a plot there? Because then you would be able to grow Batavia lettuce most winters, especially if you invested in some row covers, some spun polyester row covers or some plastic little hoop houses. You could certainly grow them all spring, all fall. The time that you can't grow lettuce outdoors is in the summertime because it bolts. It is a cool season crop. Lettuces and spinaches, they grow best in the fall, in the spring. And with some protection, they can grow darn well over the winter. Another option is, do you utilize any of the different farmers markets or anything like that around Philadelphia?
Well, I looked the one in Rittenhouse Square. There's one by Fittler Square. So I only got back a week and a half ago, but
right.
I hit both of those up, and they didn't know what I was asking about.
Right, but were they selling salad greens?
They were selling salad greens.
But you've also found the Batavia seeds online, right, at the different seed companies.
Exactly. So I know I can get the seeds. For me, it was more of a question of, you know, what was the best way for me to create it if I can't buy it?
One, I told you the community garden where you can grow it outdoors. The second is to order a bunch of packs of seeds and give them to these farmers and ask them to grow it for you. That is the whole philosophy behind a true CSA or a farmer's market. The farmer wants to only grow things that people want. If you guarantee you'll buy a certain amount, whatever time of year they can produce it, you're their best advertisement, because you'll be constantly talking it up to your friends and you'll create a demand for it, and it will become more common at farmers markets. They would love to grow it for you, and they won't make any of the rookie mistakes. Now, if you want to grow it inside, the easy answer is there are now a whole bunch of very compact grow light systems that use LED lighting. And these things are not very big. They're the size of like a computer keyboard. So you could make sure you had a nice light loose seed starting mix, you know, had good drainage and everything like that. You would want to keep, even though it's LEDs, you got to keep the tops of the plants very close to the light, so you want it to be movable up and down, so when the lettuce sprouts or babies, they're right up near the light, and then as they get taller, you can drop them down so they're not like crushing the lights, but they're always about half an inch away, and then when they reach a certain size, you can start cutting them, and they will continue to grow. What I would advise you to do is either work out the deal with the farmer or get a little plot in this community garden. Or if you know somebody over there, get yourself a little corner of one of their plots. And if you want to buy one of these devices, they're pretty expensive. They're like $100, $150 a piece. But I have one in my own home. an LED grow system. And right now I'm growing alpine strawberries in it. I grew a nice amount of lettuce in it. The good thing about these kind of systems, because it's inside, then you could grow your Batavia lettuce in the summertime as well.
Yeah.
When it would be difficult to get it from a supplier or grow it yourself outside, that's when your little indoor garden could come in handy. And once you get one of these things, you'd wind up rotating all sorts of flowers and different little crops and herbs through it.
That sounds great.
So you got three good options, man.
Fantastic.
All right. Good luck, man.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Wendy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Hello. How are you?
I am very good, Wendy. How is Wendy?
Wendy's fine. And I'm in Chadsford, Pennsylvania.
Very good. So what can we do for Wendy in Chadsford?
Well, I have a question about winter weeds. I have noticed during the last, well, several years, in one of my gardens in particular, and also in a gravel driveway I have, winter weeds come up. They're very small. They're easy to pick out, but they're very numerous. And I don't think something like preen is effective when it's cold. Can I do anything about winter weeds to prevent them from coming up?
Now, first of all, you talk about your driveway, which I presume is a gravel driveway.
Yes.
Right. You realize, don't you, that this is the perfect planting area, that nature really enjoys gravel driveways. There's just thousands of plants she can put in there and does. So if you're going to spray herbicides on a gravel driveway to try to keep the weeds down, that's when I'm going to go for the impervious surface and say, please just pave it over and stop using all those chemicals. I have a gravel driveway as well. And I used to play around with flame weeders and herbicidal soaps and safe methods of trying to keep weeds at bay. And, you know, quickly found out it was relentless and thankless. And then I visited a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Wichita, Kansas, in which the driveway and parking lot appeared to be grassy, but also was supporting the weight of cars after some heavy rainstorms. And that's when they showed me that the driveway and the parking lot were made of these permeable pavers, and they're designed to let plants grow up through them, and then you simply mow over top of them, and you get the best of both worlds. You get a solid surface to drive on and park your car on, but you also get much better management of your storm water, your rain water, and of course you have more plants storing carbon dioxide and putting oxygen into the atmosphere.
I've heard of those, so maybe we'll consider that.
And the other alternative is, if you don't want to change anything, is in the spring when everything gets all melty and everything, just have somebody level out your driveway, because I know my driveway, half of it is in my raised beds right now from snow being plowed. Level out your driveway, allow whatever comes up to grow until it fills in, and then simply mow it like a lawn. Either way you mow it, and it totally supports the weight of cars, it never gets wet spots or... The plants that nature plants are much more hardy than turf grasses. And either way, just mowing them on a regular basis is not only the ecologically sound alternative, but it looks great. I had no idea it was going to turn into such a fabulous look. But we have people coming by to ask us how we achieve this. You know, it's been raining for 2 weeks and our cars seem to be parked on a lawn without leaving ruts. And then you just explain it's just gravel underneath and you just mow it once a month.
Okay.
On your garden beds.
Uh-huh.
Next fall, or this fall, I should say, when the fall leaves come down, make sure you save and shred as many of them as you can. And then put 2 inches of shredded leaves over top of your garden beds before the bad weather hits. That'll smother any little weeds like chickweed. It'll prevent more from growing. It'll help keep the nutrients in your soil. And earthworms will move in because of that leaf litter and tremendously improve the soil underneath so that any plants you put in the springtime will absolutely flourish without any added fertilizers from you.
Okay. Well, that'll keep me busy and out of trouble this spring.
That's what gardeners need to do. Stay out of trouble. I've been trying for 30 years now.
Okay. Well, thank you for your help. I do appreciate it.
Good luck, Wendy.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Mike.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. How and when to feed your lawn and not break the law while doing it? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. Dick in Fishers, Indiana writes, "We've been using a well-known national service for our lawn care, and they fertilize several times through the summer. But I've heard you say that lawns don't need to be fed during the growing season. How often do we really need to fertilize our lawn? We listen to you on WBST 92.1 FM. Do you know exactly where in Indiana they're located?"
Yeah, that's our station in Muncie, which is just to the north of Indianapolis. Now, let me start by saying that overfeeding of lawns and feeding them at the wrong time of year puts a lot of chemical fertilizers into the environment that our poor beleaguered planet don't need. And it weakens the lawn, causing the grass to grow too fast and leading to pest and disease problems.
And water pollution. Isn't that why Maryland and Virginia just passed new laws regulating the feeding of lawns?
Yep. Those laws were specifically passed to try and protect the Chesapeake Bay and the waterways that lead into it. They were prompted, among other things, by research that found that a staggering 44% of all the fertilizers that were sold in Maryland were going on to lawns.
That's crazy.
Yeah, yes, it is. And congratulations to the lawmakers in those states for acting to stop the madness, despite intense lobbying by the lawn care industry. Now, to our question. These new regulations pretty much mirror my basic lawn feeding advice. If you have a cool season lawn like bluegrass, rye, or fescue, it should be fed twice. Once in the spring, the new laws specify after March 1st, and again in the late summer, early fall, or before November 15th, legal-wise.
So our listener is correct that summer feedings are bad.
For a cool season grass, absolutely. Bluegrass, fescue, and rye are already stressed at the height of summer, and feeding them at that time just makes things worse. But, you know, Dick might have a warm season grass like zoysia. If that's the case, then his grass should be fed in the summer, but only in the summer. Two equal feedings, one after it greens up for the season and another before it goes dormant for the winter.
But how can people tell which kind of grass they have?
Well, cool season grasses predominate in the north. They may stop growing over the winter, but they're going to remain green. Warm season grasses like zoysia, Bermuda, St. Augustine, and centipede predominate in the south. They go tan and dormant when temperatures drop below 50 degrees or so.
Okay, so how much should you feed?
Well, again, I think these new laws got it right. Each feeding should deliver just under a pound of nitrogen, the primary lawn food, per 1,000 square feet of turf. But no phosphorus, which is the worst water pollutant, unless a soil test shows it's necessary. And, you know, people should always return their clippings to the lawn. Those clippings are 10% nitrogen, and that gives the lawn a bonus feeding every time you mow, a bonus that's legal and very safe for the environment.
Which leads to a question we frequently get. Doesn't leaving the clippings on a lawn cause a buildup of thatch?
Nice setup. Why do I feel like you should be distracting a crowd while I take their watches? Anyway, it's just the reverse. Thatch, an unsightly buildup of dead, browned-out stolons at the soil line, is caused by overfeeding with chemical fertilizers. Returning clippings to the lawn, especially in pulverized form from a mulching mower, increases the biological activity at the soil line, and that reduces the thatch.
So clippings are a cure and not a cause. Nice. Now, we have a related question from someone who lives in one of the states with these new lawn care laws, Doug in Fredericksburg, Virginia, who writes, "This year I'm turning over a new leaf and taking your advice to use corn gluten meal on my lawn. I've read articles on its use, but none were clear on when to apply it. When is the best time to apply corn gluten to my lawn?
Well, it's a moving target as opposed to a specific date if you want the most benefit, Doug. Corn gluten meal is a perfect lawn fertilizer. It delivers pretty much exactly the amount of nitrogen the new regulations specify, and in a natural slow-release form that's ideal for both the lawn and our waterways. But, as we've mentioned many times, corn gluten meal is also a natural pre-emergent that can prevent the germination of dormant seeds, specifically crabgrass.
And to both feed and weed, you need to apply the corn gluten just as your local forsythia and red buds begin to bloom.
Yes, and more specifically, that's when soil temperatures reach 55 degrees Fahrenheit as measured 4 inches down, which you can easily do with a soil thermometer or maybe via your state extension system's website. Interestingly enough, it's also when nearby bodies of water reach that temperature. So Doug can monitor the Chesapeake Bay and get his gluten down when it starts to approach 55 degrees in the water.
So I guess paying attention to the bay helps you protect the bay.
Hey, that's my line. Wait a minute, where's my watch? Well, that sure was an informative look at legal lawn care, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to overfeed my fescue if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. And as always, if you send us an email with a question, a comment, something about the show,
please, please, please tell us where you live. Please, please, please put your location. Oh, it's so important to us. Yes, it is.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We like saying her name so much that we continue to welcome our new production assistant, Marissa Nicosia, to the show. I'm your hopefully welcome host, Mike McGrath, and I'll bounce across the bluegrass to see you again next week. Has this miserable winter done damage to your poor plants? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to tell if those precious plants are really most sincerely dead or just pining for the fjords. Plus your fabulous phone calls.